On October 3, 1980, a bomb was detonated outside a synagogue on Köpernick Street in Paris. 3 decades later, French investigators finally identified a suspect in the case. A Lebanese-Canadian sociology professor living a quiet life on the outskirts of Ottawa, Canada. Is Hassan Diab guilty?
Can you introduce yourself?
Or is he a scapegoat?
Hassan Diab.
From Canada Land, this is The Köpernick Affair. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Jordan is key to U.S. diplomacy in the Middle East. That relationship is now at risk.
If people are forced against their will to leave Gaza and settled in Jordan, this will be seen as a declaration of war.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what's at stake after a closed-door meeting in Washington?
In Germany, people are using an app to decide how to vote.
It's kind of a normal questionnaire, like, which Star Wars character am I? But it's more in what party am I?
Plus, the mysterious core of planet Earth.
If we ever see something from the core of our planet, the whole Earth has probably exploded and we're probably not around to make the measurements.
Nevertheless, there's been a new discovery about what the core looks like.
And we'll hear what Mexican moviegoers think about that French musical about Mexican drug cartels.
All ahead today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Jordan's King Abdullah met with President Donald Trump today in Washington. The president had just threatened to withhold aid if Jordan refuses to go along with his proposal to remove Palestinians from Gaza and send many of them to Jordan. After the meeting, King Abdullah said he would be convening Arab nations to make their own plan. President Trump said the U.S. would move ahead with its plan.
We're going to keep it, and we're going to make sure that there's going to be peace, and there's not going to be any problem, and nobody's going to question it.
We talked about what's at stake with Dawood Kitab, a Palestinian journalist based in Amman. He told us that Jordanians are responding to President Trump's plan for Gaza with wall-to-wall opposition.
From the public, from the private, from the NGOs, from the opposition group, from the Islamic groups, from the leftist groups. Nobody's left that has not opposed the statement and supported the king's position of refusal to ethnically cleanse Gaza, to settle people in Jordan or any other country. Every country has its own needs and interests and sovereignty. And I think the U.S. should respect sovereignty as it wants people to respect their sovereignty.
If Jordan were made to absorb a significant number of people from Gaza, it would change the country's demographics. You know, a country where the population already has a large number of displaced Palestinians. How does that factor into Jordan's unwillingness to have this conversation?
You are right that the demographic balance or imbalance would be even worse. And some of the tribal leaders in Jordan would feel like their ability to have their country would be removed even further. So, yes, it would destabilize the country. I mean, the King Abdullah is the unifier of the country and the different factors and different backgrounds of the people of Jordan. But nobody on either side of the divide, if you will, whether it's Jordanians of Palestinian origin or East Bank Jordanians, will accept to have their country, you know, turned over this way.
President Trump has suggested that he might withhold aid to both Jordan and Egypt if they don't cooperate with his plan to take control of Gaza and resettle the population in those two countries. Jordan receives $1.5 billion in annual assistance from the U.S. Can you paint a picture of what it would mean for that aid to be withheld to Jordanians?
Let's just put things in perspective. Jordan is the second Arab country after Egypt to sign a peace treaty with Israel. Jordan has the biggest borders with the Israeli troops, and Jordan hosts multiple U.S. bases. So the money that Jordan is getting, most of it is going for the military and for the national security of Jordan, which is actually part of the strategy of the national security, regional security of the U.S. So this is not a gift that is given to Jordan. It's earned money that is part of a strategic alliance.
You say that this is a strategic alliance between Jordan and the United States. Jordan worked with the U.S. during the war on terror back when other countries in the region opposed that effort. Can you tell me more about how that strategic alliance has worked in more recent years? What has the U.S. relied on Jordan for, and what has Jordan gotten out of that relationship?
Jordan has one of the biggest embassies in the Middle East, and Jordan is a regional hub for the U.S., most Jordanian-U.S. relations in the region, whether it's in Palestine, Israel, or whether it's in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq. There are many diplomats and politicians, and the contractors are all based in Jordan, and Jordan is providing security buffer country for U.S. interests, and it also provides stability for the region. So it's a very important region. Yes, during the war on terror, during the first and second wars in Iraq and Iran and so on, Jordan has always been a strong, reliable ally to the U.S.
In addition to the meeting between the U.S. president and the King of Jordan, there is another story preoccupying the region today. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will abandon the ceasefire in Gaza unless Hamas releases all the remaining hostages by Saturday. Can you make a connection here for us between that demand and the meeting today between the U.S. and Jordan?
First phase is almost over, but the Israelis are hesitating on a number of issues and are not delivering their part of the deal. And so Hamas threatened that if the Israelis don't respect their part of the deal, then some of the prisoners will not be released on Saturday. And this produced a strong statement from President Trump, as well as Netanyahu, wanting all the prisoners to be released, and which is welcomed if the Israelis want all the prisoners to be released and ending the war, which is the basic agreement of the ceasefire, then that's fine. But the Israelis don't want to end the war. They want to keep the war, but they want the hostages to be released. And, you know, nobody's going to do that. And it violates their own signed agreement that is sponsored by the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt. All three countries sponsored that Israel will deliver its part of the deal, which is to end the war and to have their hostages returned.
Dawood Kutab is a Palestinian journalist based in Amman.
Germany holds elections later this month with 630 seats in the Bundestag up for grabs. Germans are mistrustful of politics, especially in this time of polarization. As many as a quarter of voters have not decided which party or candidate to support, if they support anyone. As Valerie Hamilton reports from Munich, there's an app for that.
Even if you're into German politics, keeping up with it these days is hard. Ask Kiki Putz.
Throughout like 3 months, our federal finance minister was dismissed. Our chancellor lost a vote if he should still be our chancellor. And now there will be new elections. That happened so fast. I've never seen anything like this.
Putz is a graphic designer and educator. She's also a first-time voter. She's 22. And she says news media, social media, and political party messaging are not making the decision easy.
Right now, it's very hard to distinguish between neutral sources and, well, not neutral sources.
Enter the Wahl-O-Mat, Germany's favorite nonpartisan, publicly funded online voter decision tool. The name means vote-o-matic, but you can think of it like a dating app for elections. You answer a series of policy questions, yes, no, or neutral, and the app compares your answers with answers given by the political parties to spit out a list of potential matches. The Wahl-O-Mat is an institution, part of Germany's political culture for more than two decades.
My grandma uses it. My parents use it. Basically, everyone in Germany has heard of the Wahl-O-Mat.
It's put out by the nonpartisan Federal Agency for Civic Education to show how the parties differ. The result is
kind of a normal questionnaire, like, which Star Wars character am I? But it's more in what party am I?
Germany's political landscape can feel kind of like the bar scene in Star Wars. Among the parties competing for votes are the seven parties in the current Bundestag, plus nearly two dozen smaller long-shot parties, from the animal protectionists to the pirate party. In Germany, it's not a question of just voting red or blue. It's a whole rainbow.
It's very difficult to get an overview about all parties. The Wahl-O-Mat can help you to get a little bit more orientation in a rather complex field of a lot of parties we have in Germany.
That's political scientist Stefan Marshall. He's a Wahl-O-Mat old-timer. He's advised on the tool since 2003 and leads research on its impact. What he's found is it's really popular. Half of German voters have used it at least once. And he says these days, voters worried about fake news and disinformation rely on the Wahl-O-Mat even more.
A lot of people are looking for orientation and for tools which provide, in their eyes, solid and serious information on the parties and their positions.
Orientation, yes. Shortcut, no. Using the Valomat means you have to engage with some tough political questions. Like, should Germany keep supplying weapons to Israel? Should the state relax its strict limits on debt? And the perennial conundrum, should there be a speed limit on the Autobahn? Marshall says educating people about the debate can help engage them more in politics.
To create a little bit more awareness and to erase some prejudice people have on politics, for example, that parties are all the same and it doesn't make a difference which party is in power. In the Valomat, by indicating the difference between parties, makes aware that it does make a difference.
In this election, that's especially important.
Deutschland, was ist los mit dir?
A campaign ad by the Christian Democrats asks, Germany, what's going on with you? Voters seem to be asking the same. Germans are unhappy with the current government and unhappy with their choices to replace it. All of the major party candidates for chancellor have disapproval ratings of more than 60%. If Undecided were a candidate, it would be second in the polls. And so it's no surprise that in its first 3 days, people used the Valomat 15 million times, 50% more than in the same time span last time around. It's on track for a new record, which may make the Valomat the most successful campaign of this German election. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton.
Your science textbook from grade school, it probably had an illustration of the Earth sliced in half, revealing perfectly concentric rings from the crust down to the core. Well, a study published this week in the journal Nature Geoscience suggests the Earth's core may not be a perfect ball after all. The going theory seems to be the core changes shape. Jessica Irving is a geophysicist at the University of Bristol in the UK. She did not conduct this research, but she is following it with interest.
So what we see when we think about the layers of the Earth is we've got the rocky stuff we know about on the top, the crust and the mantle. And then deep beneath that, we've got this huge ball of iron. The outer parts of the ball of iron are liquid. They're still really hot, but they're liquid. The inner parts of the ball make up the inner core. And that inner core is made of solid iron. And what this new paper is seeing is that as well as maybe spinning at a slightly different speed to the rocky bits of the Earth, it looks like the very outside of the inner core might be a little bit squishy. And that squishiness, that ability to deform, means that if we look at it with seismic waves, it actually looks a bit different this year than it would have a few years ago.
So you called it squishy. The core has also been described as blobby. What does that mean exactly, and why is it important?
Well, we know that the inner core is a solid, but it's not a perfect solid. And at its edge, it's really quite close to being so hot that even under high pressure, it would melt. So if you think of it like a piece of fruit, it's still a solid, but you can just squish it at the edges if you need to. That's what we're seeing with this study in the inner core.
So, Jessica, can you help us understand how the research team that published this paper came to the conclusion that the shape of the core has likely changed? I mean, the core of the Earth, it's about 4,000 miles or so down beneath the crust. We live above the crust. We can't get cameras down there. So what did they do?
You're right. We're never going to get cameras down there, despite what Hollywood might tell us. And it's really deep. So it's about the distance from London to Boston, beneath all our feet. What these researchers did was use earthquakes that happened in the same place but a few years apart and looked at the seismic signals, so the waves you get from an earthquake. They did this by looking at seismic signals recorded on completely the opposite side of the Earth. So earthquakes near Antarctica were recorded in northern Canada and Alaska. And when they looked at signals from a few years ago compared to a few years later, what they were able to see was that the bits of the signal corresponding to waves which go through this deepest layer, the inner core, those signals looked a bit different. And that's how they've been able to piece together this story.
Just fundamentally, Jessica, why is the core, the center of our planet, so important to life on the surface of the Earth?
It seems really far away, but actually the core is where Earth's magnetic field is made. So the core has this huge amount of liquid iron swirling around, and that makes the magnetic field that we can detect on the surface of the Earth. That magnetic field actually shields us from cosmic particles.
Wow.
So although you might not think about it every day, the core is really important for our day-to-day life. It's just pretty hard to study.
That's geophysicist Jessica Irving at the University of Bristol commenting on new research this week about the shape of the Earth's core. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. For the first time in more than 2 years, Lebanon has an actual government. President Joseph Aoun appointed his cabinet over the weekend. This marks the start of a delicate chapter in Lebanon's history, with the powerful Shia party Hezbollah appearing to have less influence than before. The World's Shirin Jafari has the story.
Hezbollah is a political party in Lebanon. It also has a paramilitary wing, which has waged several wars with the country's neighbor to the south, Israel. The latest round of clashes took place in the aftermath of October 7th and Israel's response in Gaza.
Hezbollah basically determines to a large degree whether there will be war or peace in Lebanon.
Paul Salem is with the Middle East Institute, a think tank in Washington. He says the powerful Shia group played a less direct role in the formation of the cabinet in Lebanon this time around. The parties were told to nominate candidates, he says. Hezbollah put in several names. The prime minister chose two.
If you look at the list of ministers, it's in general a very impressive, very highly educated, very clean group of people.
Hezbollah didn't want to get involved in a drawn-out battle over the formation of the government, says Sami Halabi with the Lebanese think tank Triangle. The group has been dealt a heavy blow by Israel, he says, which killed its leader Hassan Nasrallah and many of its mid-level officials by detonating their personal pagers.
They got a couple of seats in one key position in the finance ministry, and they're happy with that for the moment.
Washington had a major influence in how this cabinet came about, he says, and it's happy with the result. Last week, Morgan Ortegas, who was recently appointed as the Deputy Special Envoy for Middle East Peace, met with Lebanese officials in Beirut. She spoke about Hezbollah at a press conference afterwards.
We have set clear red lines from the United States that they won't be able to terrorize the Lebanese people, and that includes by being a part of the government.
Halabi says Washington's message was clear.
Often, as we're seeing now with the Trump administration, the decision-making is haphazard. It's not placed in historical context. It's off the cuff. But I think in this case, we are seeing a rare exception, if it is only at the behest of the enemy of my ally is my enemy.
In other words, he says, the U.S. sees Lebanon through Israeli interests. Israel is opposed to Hezbollah having any influence in Lebanon. It wants it to disarm and disband. The U.S. wants that too. Last month, in its final days, the Biden administration moved more than $100 million in military aid from Israel and Egypt to Lebanon. The money, it said, would be used to rebuild police stations, improve radio communications, and buy vehicles. But Halabi says this is not the end of Hezbollah in Lebanon.
They still have widespread support. They still have widespread influence through that support. And as a result, they have a legitimate level of representation.
The future of Hezbollah's public support will depend on how much it can help rebuild southern Lebanon. That's according to Rhonda Slim. She's a fellow with the Foreign Policy Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Speaking from Beirut, Slim says the majority of Hezbollah's supporters live in the south. That part of the country saw the most destruction from the recent Israeli attacks.
There is right now a quite high level of anger against Hezbollah. Maybe 40 to 50% blame Hezbollah for making the strategic mistake of deciding to join the war in support of Hamas, and they were forced to pay the price for that decision.
Hezbollah has been handing out cash payments to residents of these areas, Slim says. It's been paying between $6,000 and $8,000 to help those who lost their homes, rent new spaces, and buy new furniture. How long Hezbollah can continue these payments is another question, she says. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The global watchdog group Transparency International is warning that corruption is putting international cooperation on climate change in jeopardy. The NGO released its annual Corruption Perceptions Index today, with many nations at the forefront of climate diplomacy seeing their scores get worse. Scott Greytak is with Transparency International. He says most of those countries are Western and industrialized.
from the United States and its role in spending billions, hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars in combination with other countries around the world, to Scandinavia, to Australia and New Zealand. Whenever you have so much money being spent in order to alleviate and combat the effects of climate change, you have tremendous risks of that money being misappropriated, wasted, or even stolen.
So the report released today says corrupt forces are blocking climate action around the globe. What are those forces, and do you find them in these Western countries?
Unfortunately, you find most of them in Western countries. These are often oil and gas companies that will exert tremendous political pressure, both directly through lobbying efforts to campaign contributions to influence the election campaigns of the politicians who go on to make decisions about climate appropriations.
What countries are you most concerned about in terms of corruption affecting the follow-through of climate change mitigation projects?
I mean, one that stuck out particularly this year is Venezuela, which has had very low corruption scores, certainly for the past decade. This year, they slid even more spaces on the index. Venezuela sits on one of the largest oil reserves in the world. Obviously, that state-owned company there has tremendous influence on, you know, global oil outputs and affecting carbon emissions. So when you see countries like that, same story with Russia, which saw itself slide a few spots in the rankings this year, that are such strong players in the global oil economy. And so where they could have accountable government, transparent government, so we know what the inputs and the outputs related to those industries are, they can have humongous ramifications for the rest of us.
So Scott, is your concern that corruption could affect climate change mitigation in some countries, or is there already actual evidence that it's having that effect?
I don't think there's any question that the influence of wealthy lobbying interests have frustrated the ability, especially in more developed Western countries like the United States, like countries in Western Europe, to be able to mitigate the effects of climate change. That's well documented. What I think is remaining more to be seen is as the world comes together increasingly to try to deal with the effects of climate change and are collecting, organizing, and appropriating hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars towards this, if there are leaks in the bucket when that money is being moved from one source to another across the world, how much of that money is going to fall prey to what we know are already corrupt systems?
Yesterday, President Trump paused the enforcement of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which makes it illegal for companies that operate in the U.S. to pay foreign government officials to secure business deals. How do you see that playing into this whole dynamic?
It's very unfortunate news. The FCPA, when it was passed, was a model law. It was the first in the world to say that we are not going to allow our citizens or companies that are based or registered on a stock exchange in the United States to go around the world and to corrupt the officials of those other nations in order to win contracts, licenses, permits, business opportunities. This has been a global norm for almost 50 years. The United States was one of the lead organizations in standing up a global instrument and has worked to get dozens of countries on board with passing and enforcing similar laws. So the fact that the United States, the first country in the world who took this important step, is now, at the least, pausing those efforts is not going to be good for anybody.
Scott Greytak is Director of Advocacy at Transparency International's U.S. office in Washington. More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Birth rates have been falling across industrialized nations. In country after country, there's growing concern about aging workers and faltering economies. In Turkey last year, for example, the birth rate hit a record low, 1.51 births per woman. That prompted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to declare 2025 the year of the family. He gave a speech calling on each woman to have three children. The government is even offering financial incentives. The World's Duri Buscarin reports on how the request is landing with prospective parents.
Here's this anecdote that gets passed around between women in Turkey. Say there are two friends, Aisha and Fatima. Aisha calls Fatima to see if she wants to hang out today. And Fatima says, oh, I'd love to, but I can't. I'm at his home and I can't leave him. He doesn't know how to use the stove and he won't be able to make himself dinner. So let's hang out another time. So here's the question for you. Who is Ahmet?
Bu Ahmet, kadının kocası.
If you thought it was her husband, you would be right. Not her child, not a person with a disability that prevents them from using a stove.
Bir erkek büyüyünce, yani annesi olmadan...
This is Özlem Çalar, She's 33, a mother of two, and she says that in Turkey, many men are raised not to share responsibilities at home. Now, this is not just a Turkish problem, and there are always men who are exceptions, she says. But Çağlar tells me that a big part of family planning comes down to who you're planning a family with. Women don't have kids right away anymore, Çağlar says. They want to wait to make sure that a marriage is going to work out and that the other person is ready for the responsibility. Çağlar faces a lot of these issues in her own home. For instance, when she was studying for a civil service exam, her partner didn't help with the chores or look after their kids. Everyone expects everything from me, Çağlar says. I sacrifice my sleep, my time with my friends. I woke up at 6 a.m. to study before the kids woke up, and I completed the house chores after they went to sleep. Çağlar isn't alone. I spent the day talking to women in Istanbul about their decisions to have or not have children. And while this isn't exactly a scientific survey, everyone talked about the economy, about gender roles, and their concerns for the future. It's because of the circumstances of the country and of the world, says 28-year-old Ece Yaşarmak. I don't feel like I'll be able to provide for a child of my own. It's the economy, it's climate change, it's the future of the world and the country, she says. But some people I spoke to miss the larger families of the old days. At a mall in Istanbul, Haydar Uzun carries his grandson, while his daughter pops into a store. I love kids, but being a grandpa is hard, he laughs. His baby grandson laughs too. Having smaller families is a Western idea, Uzun says. We used to have 15 people in a household. Having smaller families changes the structure of society, and it alienates us from each other.
2025 aile yılı tanıtım programı münasebetiyle
last month, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan unveiled what he's calling Turkey's Year of the Family. Low-income families welcoming their first child this year will receive financial assistance equal to about $40 a month until the child is five. Second, third, and fourth children will receive larger sums.
Türkiye genç ve nitelikli nüfus bakımından
Turkey is losing blood in terms of its young and qualified population, Erdogan said. If we do not take precautions as soon as possible and implement necessary policies in a short time, the problem will be irreparable. In his speech, Erdogan blamed declining fertility rates and a rising divorce rate. He lamented that men and women are getting married later in life.
Bunlar kriz koşullarında çok komik rakamlar olarak.
Esin İzel Uysal, a Turkish human rights attorney, says the financial incentives are almost ridiculous, given Turkey's economic situation. The government needs more people to work, and someone needs to create those babies for the workforce, Uysal says. But policies promoting birth can increase the risk of violence against women, according to Uysal. She says as Turkish leaders pressure women to have more children and even bow out of the workforce, it sends a dangerous message.
Kadın erkek eşit değil diye düşünüyorum.
The government is openly saying that women and men are not equal and that women should stay at home and take care of the family, Uysal says. At a high-end mall, a young mother named Sinem looks exhausted. She asked not to use her full name as she hands her three-year-old daughter a banana and an iPad, hoping she'll calm down.
Çok zorlandığım şey oluyor. Yardım pek almıyorum.
It's really hard for me, and I don't get much help, she says. She used to work as a school administrator, but had to quit after having a baby during the pandemic. She says she'll stick with just one child, regardless of what the government wants. For the world, I'm Derya Buscarin, Istanbul.
Sticking with that theme here of countries trying to get young people to start families, marriage rates have been falling in Asian countries. They plummeted especially fast last year in China, where marriage registrations dropped by 20% from the previous year. 20% in 1 year. That is the steepest decline on record. And what's keeping Chinese couples from tying the knot, that isn't totally clear. Leita Hung Fincher is the author of Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality, inequality in China. I asked her what's behind the drop-off in new marriages.
Partly it is because the Chinese government imposed these population planning policies, the most famous being the one-child policy for many decades. So there are just fewer people of marriage age. But one thing that is extremely significant that I have been researching for many years is a dramatic change in the attitude of young women in China towards marriage. About 10 years ago, most young women in China felt like they had no choice but to get married. But in recent years, young women today in China are increasingly just saying, no, I really don't want to get married. And that's also related to an unwillingness to have babies.
Are there economic factors at play here also, like there are for decisions around having children?
Of course. With the increasing cost of living, the cost of housing, cost of education, the rising cost of everything all across China, young people, and it's not just women, young men as well, just feel enormous pressure and they want to take care of themselves more. I mean, it really is a seismic change. So if you look at China's population has been shrinking for 3 straight years. I mean, that's huge. So now India is the most populous country in the world. China's economy is growing at much slower rates. And we don't even know what the actual rates are because the government massages those rates. So there are a whole slew of problems related to this dramatically changing demographic makeup. I mean, the workforce is shrinking, and the proportion of the elderly compared to the young is also increasing. So this has really enormous implications for the world as well as for China.
Could you share some of those personal stories you've heard from Chinese women in recent years about their changing attitudes toward marriage?
Well, on the one hand, the government is cracking down on feminist activism, jailing some of the more extreme feminist activists. But on the other hand, there's this just mainstream popularization of attitudes such as, you know, if you're a young woman, you definitely don't need to marry if you don't want to. Another sign of the popularity of feminism is this Japanese feminist sociologist named Chizuko Ueno, whose books about feminism in Japan are bestsellers. They've been translated into Chinese and they're bestsellers in mainland China. Mm. So Xi Jinping has actually come out and said China needs to adopt a new type of marriage and child-rearing culture. And so there's a whole slew of policies and very sexist propaganda. I mean, the term leftover women refers to a government official term describing women in China who are 27 years old or single. Just the effort was to try to shame them and to make them feel bad about being single and to push them into getting married. So that was successful for a time when it was first introduced back in 2007, but it's no longer successful. You know, trying to push women into these really traditional roles of a subservient wife and mother in the home, those policies are basically failing.
You mentioned this label that the government has put on unmarried women over 27, leftover women. What else has China been doing to try to promote marriage and child rearing? And why isn't it working?
For example, one policy was, well, if you get married in this particular region of China and you're a newlywed couple and the bride is 25 years old or younger, you get a cash bonus. But the cash bonus is just so laughably, it's just a pittance, like the equivalent of a little over $100. I mean, it's not going to change anybody's mind. Now, there are more coercive policies as well. For example, it's much harder for men to get a vasectomy today in China. So even though women may be reluctant to describe themselves as feminist, essentially, that's what they're doing. They're trying to find ways to be more free, to have more free will, to make their own decisions in spite of what the government is trying to do. I should say something else that is unfortunately much more difficult for women to counteract is that the government is making it much, much more difficult for women in particular to get divorced with the imposition of things like a 30-day cooling off period. That's what the government calls it. That itself is causing a lot of unmarried women who are younger to also look and say, well, I don't want to be trapped in that kind of situation. So that's making them even more reluctant to get married.
Leyte Hong Fincher is the author of Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
The White House announced today that an American teacher who'd been detained in Russia for more than 3 years has been released. Mark Fogel was arrested in August of 2021. His family said he was traveling with medically prescribed marijuana. National Security Advisor Mike Waltz said the U.S. and Russia negotiated an exchange for his release. Waltz did not say what the U.S. side of the bargain was.
Sam Kerr, one of the world's top female soccer players, was found not guilty in a London court today. The Australian footballer called a constable stupid and white during a heated exchange at a police station after a night out in London 2 years ago, but she denied that constituted racially aggravated harassment of a police officer, the charge she was cleared of today. Kerr's trial has been headline news in Australia.
And health officials are reporting an Ebola outbreak in Uganda. There's been one death so far, with 8 more people sick. No vaccines have been approved for the strain of Ebola infecting people in Uganda. The last outbreak there in 2022 lasted 4 months and killed at least 55 people.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
The movie Amelia Perez has been nominated for 13 Oscar awards. It is also mired in controversy. The latest scandal has to do with the star of the film, Carla Sofia Gaston, whose past tweets include offensive comments about everything from Islam to George Floyd, even the Academy Awards themselves. In Mexico, people are abandoning the movie for other reasons. The World's Tibi Saizea reports from Mexico City.
At a movie theater in Mexico City, only 9 people were watching Emilia Perez on a recent Sunday evening. The film is a Spanish-language musical that tells the story of a Mexican cartel boss who transitions into a woman and becomes an activist. The movie is a complete waste, says Angel Nakamura as he leaves the cinema. He had been curious to see the most nominated film at the Oscars, but he didn't like the portrayal of Mexico and Mexican culture by French director Jacques Audiard.
Optó por irse por lo banal, por lo superficial, por entender el mundo desde Europa.
He believes Audiard has an Eurocentric vision and takes a frivolous approach to the tragedy of violence in Mexico. In the movie, the main character leaves behind a life of crime to search for people who have disappeared as a result of Mexico's cartel violence. And she succeeds, making it look as if finding the disappeared is an easy task.
It's indignant.
That is outrageous, says Leti Hidalgo, a real-life activist who's been searching for her disappeared son for 15 years.
Presenta el tema de las desapariciones de una manera insensible e irrespetuosa.
The way it portrays disappearances is insensitive and disrespectful, she says.
Como si fuéramos una caricatura.
We feel as if we were a cartoon. There are over 100,000 people currently on the official list of disappeared in Mexico. And it's a deeply sensitive topic for many Mexicans. Other complaints about the movie involve the casting. None of the 3 leading actors are Mexican. And Selena Gomez, who plays the wife of a cartel boss, speaks with a strong American accent.
Sí, me imagino, pero ¿qué hace para él?
Also, the movie was not shot in Mexico, but in France. The outrage grew even more when director Jacques Audiard made what was interpreted as offensive remarks about the Spanish language.
Que l'espagnol est une langue de pays émergent. C'est une langue de pays modeste.
He said, quote, Spanish is a language of modest countries, of developing countries, of the poor and migrants. The transgender community in Mexico is also unhappy with Emilia Pérez for not presenting an authentic picture of the trans experience.
Yo soy Alejandra, soy trans y tengo 4 años de haber hecho mi transición.
Alejandra Mateus is a transgender woman living in Mexico City. She's angry because of the oversimplification of the surgeries Emilia Pérez goes through.
Andar por la vida y no vivir ningún tipo de discriminación o comentario, de hecho.
She also didn't like the fact that the transgender character goes about life in a conservative country like Mexico without facing any kind of discrimination or judgment, which is completely unrealistic, she says. Box office numbers for Emilia Pérez have lagged behind other big films in Mexico, even on the weekend it was released. But still, there are people who like the movie.
A mí me gustó mucho. Difiero mucho de las personas.
Back in the theater in Mexico City, Alex Rodriguez says he enjoyed how the film uses music. He says even if it's not the best representation of Mexico, Emilia Pérez is, after all, a fictional movie. And at least it sheds light on the vast problem of violence in Mexico. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. If you've ever found yourself in the middle of a really huge crowd, your spidey sense may have picked up on that particular moment when things began to feel out of control. That moment can turn deadly, especially if people panic and try to run. It can lead to a stampede. Scientists now say there is predictability in the chaos of crowd behavior. From Barcelona, The World's Jerry Haddon reports on what physicists are calling pedestrian dynamics. They're hoping it could save lives.
Researchers studying crowds have made a cool discovery. People, when smooshed together, behave like water.
Water, of course, has three states: gas, liquid, and solid. So people in crowds can behave like all three, depending on density. With little density, they are like a gas. When it increases, they behave like water. And when they get really packed together, they can become like a solid, like ice.
Physicist Iker Zurigel at Spain's University of Navarra says with the naked eye, you can't see these patterns. You just see lots of people moving around. But last year, Zurigel and colleagues from France decided to look closer. They started by filming this decidedly famous crowd. It's the Chupinazo, a festive and tight crush of people in the Spanish city of Pamplona. The crowd gathers each year just before the opening of the running of the bulls. You know, when thrill seekers get chased on purpose by bovines bred to fight along narrow streets of cobblestone. Zurigel and researchers from the École Normale Supérieure de Lyon filmed the crowd from a balcony, about 6,000 people in a square, packed together but not going anywhere. The physicists didn't see much in terms of movement, but then they sped the footage up, and that's when the patterns emerged.
Then when you see the videos, you realize that there is pressure is not coming only from one side. The pressure is coming from all the sides at the same time. Then the outcome is this rotation, global rotation, in one direction or the other.
Global rotation. In this case, clusters of up to 500 people swirling in unison. The paths they carved kind of look like the swirly sky in Van Gogh's famous painting, Starry Night. Physicists used to think crowds just moved in a linear push and pushback pattern. And they do, but that's actually what causes the rotation, says fellow researcher François Gou from Lyon. The first force, the push, is the forward pressure of the crowd. You know, that typical push from behind. The second force is when you say, enough.
Imagine you are being pushed by 10 people and you don't want to move.
You could try to push the 10 people pushing you, Gu says, but that's a shoving match you'd likely lose.
So if you want to stop, the best way is to go left or right, is to avoid the perturbation.
Just go the way others are going, Gu says, with the flow, as it were. The result, the collective swirling. Gu and Zurigel say these swirls are predictable and they can be an indicator of potential danger. Because the swirling doesn't start, says Zurigel, until crowd density reaches a certain threshold.
4 persons per square meter, which is a very important threshold. Imagine you are taking a shower with 4 people, right? In a small place.
As crowds grow and density moves beyond 4 people per square meter to 5, 6, 7, people begin to move in bigger swirls, says Gu. And that's when things can spin out of control.
So now imagine 500 people in your back. It's basically 10 tons. And if you have a pressure of 10 tons pushing you against the wall, I think it's very dangerous.
People get hurt or killed in surging crowds all the time, from the annual Hajj in Saudi Arabia to celebrations at holy rivers in India to rock concerts in the U.S. This was the Love Parade in Germany in 2010. Crowd density reached 8 people per square meter. 21 people were crushed to death as the crowd surged. François Gou stresses that density alone isn't necessarily dangerous. At the Love Parade, for example, there were lots of things that went wrong, like the fact that there was just one exit.
There were some critical errors before that. And my argument for that is making people stay in a tunnel for several hours without access to water, without access to toilets, and without any information of why it's going so slowly.
Still, density is one important piece of crowd management and safety. So Gou and Thuriguel are hopeful that the technology they've developed can at least offer some advanced warning when crowds begin to thicken and oscillate.
We can put a camera, intelligent cameras that with a very simple program.
A program that Gou in France created.
And this can help to at least say the authorities, as to say the management people, okay, this is happening. Please, you can go there and see, or you can be ready in case something happens.
Having authorities ready to intervene if something happens isn't as easy as it sounds, and it's not clear yet how they would make the best use of this swirl-detecting technology. Thuriguel and Gou also stress that sometimes crowds just take on a life of their own. Still, understanding pedestrian dynamics removes some of the mystery and could be one more tool in the complicated science of managing crowds. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Crowds of people in the Australian capital, Canberra, lined up for hours this weekend to get a look and a sniff of a tropical plant in bloom.
It started kind of smelling like wet laundry, dirty socks, dead rat.
It's amazing. It's overwhelming, of course.
It's beautiful like a flower, smells like death. I mean, what's not to like?
Visitors there speaking with the AP and Australia News 9 about the corpse flower, also known by its scientific name, Amorphophallus titanum. The flower's distinctive perfume attracts the insects that pollinate it in the wild.
It is a beastly blossom and is in the news because 3 of them have bloomed in Australia in recent months. The one this weekend in Canberra, another at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Sydney late last month, and a third at the Geelong Botanic Gardens near Melbourne in November. Individual plants bloom once every 5 to 7 years, so 3 in a row like this, big botany news.
The charisma of the corpse flower really is connected so tightly to its nasty, nasty smell, but then also it has the extra bonus of being just enormous. And so that huge size combined with that really stinky smell makes it just one of the most charismatic plants.
Susan Pell is executive director of the United States Botanic Garden in Washington. She says the charismatic plant is found in the wild only in western Sumatra in Indonesia, and it's an endangered species.
So they're threatened in their native habitat, and there's only about 1,000 of them thought to be left in the wild.
But gardens around the globe, including here in the U.S., actively cultivate the corpse flower and share pollen from the plant with each other.
Something that many gardens and universities do with their collections to help continue the genetic diversity of the plants in cultivation should they ever be needed to repopulate wild populations.
Pell says that a corpse flower in bloom will boost admissions at botanical gardens, but she says it's not just about gate receipts.
She says it is about getting people excited about plants.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Judy Piggott, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.